We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassin here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, the city of Prince Rupert, BC, is embarking on its largest infrastructure investment in 100 years.
Our commitment is that we will be the council that gets us back on top of things and that is exercising the fiscal discipline so that we never get behind the eight ball again.
Volunteers at Prince Edward County's First Repair Cafe in Picton, Ontario, help people fix things that might otherwise head to the landfill. A punk rock music show promises to attract all ages, and it does.
I just do it because I love it. It's like something I've done since I was a teenager. Yeah, it's just like thing that I enjoy. It's like a hobby for me.
These all-ages shows are just pretty awesome for that. Like, it's really a great opportunity to, like, see people without having, you know, be at a bar or something.
A new supportive housing building opens in Nanaimo, BC. Some 51 units built to help the unhoused.
We have tended always throughout history to ghettoize certain populations in society, and that's not the way to build a community.
And the warm winds of spring are heading our way. Toronto authorizes more than 1,000 restaurants and cafes to seat their clients on the city's sidewalks and streets.
So thank you very much for sticking with it, making it permanent, City of Toronto and Mayor.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to you. Thank you for keeping us company. After securing more than $200 million in federal and provincial funding, Prince Rupert is set to embark on the single largest infrastructure investment since its inception more than 100 years ago. $200 million might not sound like a lot, but it will only cover about a third of the infrastructure gap the city will need to fill over the next decade. Over $450 million is still needed to complete a major overhaul of critical infrastructure in the small port city of 12,000 people. This while trying to mitigate municipal tax increases of some 7.7%. Prince Rupert has been steadily growing over the past decade, both in population and economic growth. With the most recent port expansion a few years back, the port of Prince Rupert is now the fastest growing port in the country and the third largest in terms of shipping volume next to Vancouver and Montreal. Dan Messick and Smithers, British Columbia, speaks about the city's challenges with Prince Rupert Mayor Herb Pond.
It's a massive challenge. I mean, every council would love to be the council that either has 0% increases or even better still gives a little back.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd love to be that council. But the other side of that coin is, if you are too nice too often, and I use nice as a relative word, you just delay for a future council the pain. And we're living through some of that. The fact is that it costs a certain amount of money to replace any piece of sewer pipe or road or street light or buy a new fire truck. And if you aren't sort of keeping up with things, you're only creating a bigger bill down the road. Our commitment is that we will be the council that gets us back on top of things and that is exercising the fiscal discipline so that we never get behind the eight ball again. And the number that comes out the end in terms of taxation is just pure math. And so in this case, we need 7.7. I could come forward and say, well, we'll only do five. But I'd be leaving something undone that needs to be done. I'm in it to make sure that we get on top of it and that we have a sustainable city in the long run.
As we've spoken many times, there are, you know, quite a few of these infrastructure issues that, you know, are well behind, that are getting slowly getting dealt with. But on the same note, you know, Prince Rupert has seen this massive growth in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
and to the point where it's now the third largest port in Canada, which is no small thing.
Yes.
And, you know, I wonder, you know, with your discussions with higher levels of government, you know, do they realize what is needed here, and are they willing to make these continued investments to see this community and this port grow? Because it looks like it's quite vital to a lot of, especially the economy and shipping in Canada right now.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the case we make. I mean, very clearly, the $65 million that came from the premier and for the water pipes, the $77 million that came from the federal government for the water pipes, that didn't come because, you know, I have a winning smile and I can persuade people. It came because we could make that case, the very case that you outlined. If you spend any time around Prince Rupert, what you witness is the Canadian economy in action, right? You see containers that are going all over Canada or coming from all over Canada. You see prairie grain, you see lumber products from across the province and across Alberta. Our coal is coming from other parts of the province. This port enables all kinds of parts of the British Columbia and Canadian economy to be unlocked. We punch way above our weight when it comes to that. And yet, at the same time, we're a little town of 12,000, few hundred people. When we are talking to senior government, they pretty much get it. If they don't get it, we help them get it really quickly, that they can't close their eyes and just assume that the housing or the healthcare or the education or whatever else it's going to take to support that port infrastructure is going to be in place the way it might be in a Vancouver or Montreal, which are one and two. We will continue to make that case. I think the money that we've received to date speaks volumes about how much they understand the issue. And yet at the same time, we can't stop making that case. As you know, we've experienced some closures of the emergency room here in Prince Rupert. We immediately got to senior levels of government and said, look, and Canada's number three port and fastest growing port can't have emergency room closures at his hospital, right? You have to make this a priority. And we will continue to do that. I'm convinced that they get it. They sometimes need to be reminded that, you know, it's not just about the water pipes. It's about every single aspect of life in Prince Rupert. And we're going to keep making the case. And I'm convinced that's going to bear fruit. We're going to see population growth that comes with those expanding opportunities. And yet to get that population growth, we need the housing. We need the healthcare. We need the education. We need all of those pieces for this, the whole thing to work.
We'll leave it there for now.
Excellent.
But I'm sure these conversations will continue.
I love it. You know, I'd talk about this 24/7 if you let me.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Dozens of music fans showed up at the Sackville Commons on Friday night to watch three New Brunswick punk bands. There was a cover charge, but no one was turned away, not even kids. A refreshing twist, according to high school student Seth Thomas, who said that these all-ages shows are pretty awesome. This is exactly the reaction Glenn Barrington was hoping for when he started the all-age music series last January. Journalist Tori Weldon in Sackville, New Brunswick, got our ears ready for the event.
What you're hearing is a band called The Real Rejects from Moncton. They played at the Sackville Commons on Friday night as part of an all-ages rock show put on by Glenn Barrington.
It's all like punk rock, rock and roll kind of stuff.
I just volunteer myself to do this to create more programming in town for young people because it's just like not really a lot for teenagers and people between that age of like, you know, the 13 to 25 age bracket that want to do something in town that's
alternate to like your average things that happen in town, like town programming and stuff. So it's I just do it because I love it. It's like something I've done since I was a teenager. I've been putting off like all of punk shows and DIY shows since I was 15, and I'm almost 40 years old. So yeah, it's just like thing that I enjoy. It's like a hobby for me, and I just enjoy hosting and curating and creating opportunities for people to get to experience different kinds of music and share a night together.
High school student Seth Thomas was one of the 30-some people who came out that night. He's a big fan of the all-ages show.
I try to come to all of them because it's really great. A lot of the shows we have here are, you know, at Ducky's or bars, so if I go, I'd have to go with, like, a parent. And if I want to just hang out with my friends and go to a show, these all-ages shows are just pretty awesome for that. Like, it's really a great opportunity to, like, see people without having to, you know, buy, like, you know, be at a bar or something. I think there should definitely be more all-ages shows around here because, like, it kind of sucks having to wait for Sappy Fest, like, all year until I can, like, get into the music community, but it's nice to be able to have, like, this year-round, like, accessibility towards it.
Tyler Bootlier is a member of the band The Real Rejects. He's also an old friend of Glenn Barrington's. They played and booked shows together as teens in Sydney, Nova Scotia. Bootlier now lives in Moncton, and he says he was more than happy to be put on the bill.
Oh my God, it's a big benefit because back when you, with all ages shows, especially back in the day when we went to all ages shows, it was the kids putting it on. So it's like the shows in bar, you know, when you kind of like graduate to bar shows, it's like, if you're not used to the idea of how a show is put together, and you want to start putting on shows, you're kind of lost. And just the idea, not that's just as a promoter, if you're just playing in front of a group of people, you get to realize what it's like to play in front of a large group, a crowd. Some may hate you and some may like you, but at least you get to go to a bar and you're ready for that. So it's just that's where it all starts, is at the all ages point. So it's good to see that happening again.
Barrington began organizing these all ages shows last January.
Once a month for the year, I'm going to be doing an all ages show of a variety of different styles. Tonight's a punk show. We've had like a country show last month. Next month is more of like a mellow, kind of more like folky show with Nico Paulo and Stephen Lampke, which will be a really nice, like, beautiful night. Kind of just like since January, it's been great. There's been really good turnouts, like somewhere around 50, 60 people have been coming out, and like a really good span of all ages, like all ages kids, teenagers, you know, people who are 20s, 30s, 40s, all the way up to their senior ages, which is awesome. It's really great just to see like a really wide span of ages from the community coming out and enjoying something together. I think like as it progresses, like we'll get better and better, so.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nanaimo residents are getting a helping hand. They just moved into a new supportive housing building. The Cornerstone building opened its doors just a few days ago. To those experiencing homelessness or at risk of becoming unhoused, some 51 units offer 24/7 support, meal programs, life and employment skills training, health and wellness support as well. Lauren McKenzie took part in an early tour of the building before the opening, alongside MLA for Nanaimo Sheila Malcolmson and Nanaimo Mayor Leonard Krog.
This is the second supportive housing building to open after the City of Nanaimo and BC Housing signed a Memorandum of Understanding in 2020 for 6 new sites in the city. The 51-unit building will have 24/7 support and offer meal programs, life employment skill training, and health and wellness support. Each unit will have its own private washroom, shower, and kitchenette with a full-size fridge. 4 of the units will be wheelchair accessible. CHOY took part in an early tour of the building before the opening alongside MLA for Nanaimo, Sheila Malcolmson, and Nanaimo Mayor Leonard Krog. Malcolmson says this project is many years in the making. She says this supportive housing model is intended to help people in need gain and retain housing.
That's completely what the supportive housing model is about. People that tend to cycle through evictions and homelessness, supportive housing offers that wraparound to be able to set them up for success.
She says the provincial government has a responsibility to make sure there are other forms of affordable housing available as options for those who leave supportive housing. Malcolmson says those who are currently residing at Newcastle Place at 259 Terminal Avenue will be able to move into Cornerstone, allowing Newcastle Place to open up to new residents.
And I've heard from some of them, you know, been very public about they see this as a real step up, but they're also feeling a bit sad about leaving their friends and the community of support workers in Island Crisis Care.
Mayor Krogh says the city of Nanaimo is grateful for the new building.
It is an opportunity to stabilize, to move forward, as MLA Malcolmson, Minister Malcolmson has pointed out, and to integrate back into the community. We have tended always throughout history to ghettoize certain populations in society, and that's not the way to build the community. And when people are able to live in neighborhoods that may not have been the neighborhood they came from, to live with and work with others, it just builds real community. It builds a better city.
Krogh says the day is for reflection, celebration, and gratitude.
Imagine 51 people who are going to be living here safe and secure, not out there in the cold of the streets, not being pestered or in many respects exploited by others who have taken advantage of.
Cornerstone will be operated by the Nanaimo Office of the Collective Support Society, formerly known as the John Howard Society. Andrew Ferguson is the executive director of the society. He says Cornerstone will have a variety of health and safety services and supports on site that are fit for each resident.
So for everyone that comes in, our goal is to help them lead as best and as healthy life as they can, and that's individualized. So our goal, and in particular with this space, with our flex room, and with our supports, we want to be and remain adaptable to the changing needs of the people that live here in whatever ways that means, so that we can best support them to have the best lives that they can.
He says there is no set limit for how long someone can stay at Cornerstone.
There's no real term limit. We recognize that every person has a different journey, and what that may look like in terms of timeline is going to look different depending on the person. And it's really about being able to meet that person where they're at and help them get to the place that they want to be.
Marla Renee Myers is one of the new residents moving from Newcastle Place to Cornerstone on May 1st. CHOY spoke with her after the tour. She says she's been at Newcastle Place for about 3 years after living on the streets.
I've my entire life, you know, and my mom passed away, and that just pretty much broke me. Yeah. So I started collecting cans, and COVID hit, and I started collecting them in my room. I had enough to pay my rent throughout the whole time, but the second landlord was able to kick me out, he kicked me out.
She says when she was able to get into Newcastle Place, she ended up with two great social workers and got the health care and support she needed. Myers says she is grateful for the work that has been done getting Cornerstone open, but says there is more work that needs to be done.
But there's still a long way to go. You know, there's so many people still out there. And I hate to say this, but the mayor has done us no good out on the street. He may be doing something with this, but out there, you know, if you want to invest, you want to invest in security fences and security companies. And that's a shame.
When asked where she would invest her money instead of fences, she had the following to say.
Into a properly ran tent city for safety reasons alone, you know. Groups don't die together, right? It's the people that are left alone that die.
Myers says that after moving into Cornerstone, her next steps are getting back to work in construction or counseling to help those still living on the streets. This is Laura McKenzie.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
thanks for us. The Repair Cafe movement began in Amsterdam in 2009, and it was initiated by a woman called Martine Posma. She had a vision of sustainability at the local level, and one day recognized the need for the preservation of repair skills. Since then, the Repair Cafe has become an international movement, with locations set up around the globe, including Belgium, France, Germany, Japan, and India. Since then, many others have joined the movement, such as the case in the Ontario town of Picton, Prince Edward County, where a team of 8 fixers and menders offered free repairs of broken household items, small appliances, and mending of clothing to the public. People could bring their item to the Repair Cafe and use available equipment to repair it, get help from the volunteers, or let the volunteer fix it for them. The event, held in the Picton Library, was organized by Joseph Winter and Becky Lamb. Brenda Little was there.
The first Repair Cafe in Prince Edward County was organized by Joseph Winter and Becky Lamb, which took place this past Saturday in the newly renovated Picton Library. Many years ago, Joseph Winter discovered the Repair Cafe movement when he took an item for repair to one of the many cafes in Toronto, and he thought it was a great idea. Since moving to the county, he's been thinking about this for some time, and with help from Becky Lamb and 8 volunteers who have multiple skills, they were able to fix or mend all kinds of items that people brought in. The Repair Cafe is a grassroots movement that began in Amsterdam in 2009 with the idea of fixing broken items and keeping them out of the landfill, as well as preserving repair skills, which seem to have diminished through the years. Volunteer Suzanne said professional repair is too expensive, so people normally throw things away since it's cheaper to buy a new item. But in these hard times, that's not always possible. Co-organizer Becky Lamb agreed and added that keeping things out of the landfill sites is important. I chatted with organizer and fixer Joseph Winter.
Joseph, would you tell me how this all got started, please?
For the last several years, I've just been repairing things that I found broken to use myself or to give away to other people. And I'd been familiar with the Repair Cafe model internationally. And I thought, why not bring it to Picton? Because it's a lot of people have things that need fixing and don't know how to do it. And I just thought, what the heck, let's give it a go.
How many people have you had here today?
Oh, we've had, I'm sure, 50 or 60 people through, and about, I know last count, more than 30 items repaired of a whole variety of different things.
How did you get this group together, Joseph?
Well, most of the people I know personally, and I know that there's just skilled individuals and others. Some just literally found out about the event through the posters and reached out to us. So we have 2 people, in fact, who we had not met before. So now we know new people in the community as well, which is awesome. And
do you think you'll do this again next year?
Maybe even this fall. Maybe have a semi-annual thing in the fall. We'll see. We're hoping to add things too, like bicycles. The space at the library doesn't lend itself super well currently for that, but as they're going to finish the renovations, we should be able to have more space in the back and to open that up for people as well.
So what kind of things have you been repairing today?
Everything from buttons on people's coats to tears in their clothes. And just looking over here at the library, brought one of their chairs down that they were about to throw away, and we have successfully repaired it. So now it's going right upstairs back to the library. I have many turntables, a lot of electronics, blenders, lamps, small furniture and appliances. Good range of things.
So what kind of craftspeople do you have here?
We have people of all different walks. So we have people who are very skilled with needle and thread and sewing machines. We have others that are backgrounds in furniture repair, others that are sort of mechanical engineers even, and people who have electronics experience, tinkerers, people who are just like fixing things in general and have learned over time. So it's a really good mix of skills. And if one person doesn't know how to fix something, then someone else probably does.
Anything you'd like to add?
Come bring your items to Repair Cafes anywhere you are, and we'll be happy to fix it for you.
I'm Brenda Little.
Hi, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
Toronto, Ontario now, where the city's Café TO program is set to start ahead of schedule this year. Over 1,000 patios and 500 sidewalk cafes will be open citywide from May to October. They will be given the green light for the Victoria Day weekend. The program was made permanent in 2023, with over 1,200 restaurants and cafes taking part in it that year. Café TO allows them to extend their seating onto sidewalks, curbs, and certain areas. The program was introduced in 2020 during the pandemic to allow restaurants to stay open. Here's journalist Owen Thompson listening to Toronto's Mayor Olivia Chow.
We're on track to hit our goal of at least 90% of approved Café TO patio ready to open by Victoria Day weekend.
Café TO will be running from the May 2-4 long weekend to October 15th across the city. Chow and Councillor Paula Fletcher say that last year, with the first implementation of the program, there were large amounts of quote-unquote red tape. Fletcher says that the city has removed a lot of the red tape and have made it easier for people to be a part of the program. Fletcher says,
including last year when we said we're going to make these a permanent affair, and it wasn't as easy for you last year, and Jennifer says not easy for me either. So thank you very much for sticking with making it permanent, City of Toronto and Mayor, and snip, 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 cutting all the red tape to make this easy to do. It should not be hard to do to put patios on the street, to have a signature program like Café TO that everyone loves so much in the summer. And to also have Café TO that's accessible. Doesn't matter how you're able, if you've got a walker, if you've got a wheelchair, if you've got a stroller, in our Café TO, you can get right on that patio and enjoy a cold one. I'm very happy that we're able to announce ahead of schedule. It's been a very smooth rollout. And that's the good news. Once we put our minds to something, fix it, it gets fixed.
To join Café TO, a one-time fee of $570 plus HST is to be paid, with a $29 annual renewal fee. The $570 to be paid over 3 years. Owners must pay per square foot of patio space, just costing under $15 per square foot for sidewalk and just over $43 for curbside patios. Barbara Gray, General Manager of Transportation Services, says,
We have been very fortunate in working with Economic Development and Culture and the federal government on some grant programs to help support businesses who want to pay for their patios, and that's an investment that they make.
More information on Café TO can be found on the Toronto City website. This is Owen Thompson with the Local Journalism Initiative signing off.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to Brenda Little, Tori Sheldon, Owen Thompson, Dan Messick, and Lauren McKenzie. To both our national editors, Victoria Fender and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the precious help of your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for being with us this week, and until the next, ciao. Thank you.
tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.